Dog Works Radio is sponsored by Alaska Dog Works. Check out their website at alaskadogworks.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto from Dog Works Radio, and you're listening to our mushing radio segment. And today we're joined by our guest, a dog musher calling in from the Fairbanks, Alaska area. His name is Riley Dyke, and he is signed up to run his first Yukon Quest in 2018. Here's the show.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. You are listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find us over on Apple Podcasts. Just search for Dog Works Radio. We're also on social media under the same name. And today I welcome dog musher Riley Dyke calling in from Fairbanks, Alaska. Riley, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am doing well, thank you. Could you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what you're all about, please.
My name is Riley Dyke. I'm a dog musher from Fairbanks, Alaska. I own a pretty small kennel of 25 dogs. I'll be running the Yukon Quest this year as my rookie run in that race.
And you are with Dark Horse Sled Dogs, is that right?
Yep, that's my kennel.
So, if you could, tell us how you got started in mushing. I know in your bio, you've been a handler for some pretty dang good mushers, in particular on the Yukon Quest. How did you jump into the sport?
I began running dogs in Colorado during college. My first year of college there, I just needed a job and happened to hear about an opening at a winter tour operation there. I grew up around dogs, around bird dogs and things in Iowa growing up, but never really thought about becoming a musher till I started there and was pretty much hooked right away. After a few winters there, I wanted to get into the more competitive side of mushing, so I moved up here to Alaska. I took a job with Alaska Icefield Expeditions out of Skagway on the Denver Glacier. There I met Matt Hall. He offered me a job that following winter, helping to train his young dogs and helping him kind of prep for his rookie run in the Quest. After a season with him, I moved on to handle for Ryan Olson and then Sven Altman.
So you came up from Colorado to work at a tour operation that I assume, being in Skagway, you dealt with a lot of cruise ship traffic. Can you tell us a little bit about that job? I don't think a lot of our listening public knows much about, you know, dog sledding when you're coming off of a cruise ship. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I work for what we call a heli mush operation. So the dogs and myself and five other mushers live up on a glacier above town. The only access, it's pretty remote, the only access to it is via helicopter. So we stay up there about 4 months out of the season, guests book tours through their ship or directly through us or Timsco helicopters, and then get flown up on a helicopter flight seeing tour, and then drop after about a half hour flight seeing tour, get dropped off with us where they're with us for about an hour, and we take them for a tour on the glacier about 2 miles long, and then they get to meet puppies and hang out with them. It's a really good socialization for young dogs, and it's a kind of a really good summer training program for older dogs. A great summer kind of power building program.
So for most people, Riley, that is their first experience with a sled dog and being on a sled and, you know, all of that sort of stuff that goes along with it. What are people's impressions, you know, that come from much warmer locales than where we're at up here in Alaska? What do they think when they step on that glacier for the first time?
They're generally pretty amazed. It's a pretty impressive operation, really. Alaska Ice Field Expeditions, who I work for in the summers, is a really great job. We have a lot of really talented, really successful mushers working up there, so we have a really, really pretty smooth operation. So they're usually pretty shocked to, you know, to them it feels like wintertime, even though it's a lot of times, you know, 60 to 75 degrees up there. So they're usually pretty shocked that we're in t-shirts. Yeah, it's a pretty, pretty cool experience for them. It's, like I said, real remote. So there's real mountainous, real scenic, real pretty for them, really good atmosphere for them to first see dogs in harness pulling.
It is a pretty country down there for sure. So as you worked your way in your mushing career, you had mentioned you handled for Matt Hall and Ryan Olson and Sven. How was that, getting your feet wet, you know, going from kind of a tour operation, kind of an employee type deal to really jumping into it and sort of a trial by fire with some long distance teams?
It's been really, really fun for me. I've been really lucky from a handler's perspective to work with, you know, not just successful mushers, but people that are also really good friends of mine. You know, all those guys I knew beforehand or got to know before I went into a handling situation with them. So we were already pretty good friends. So I've had a not much, like you said, not much of an employee feeling when I'm working for them. Of all the three of those mushers, I had a lot of kind of liberties and was kind of just handed a team and then by them and then mentored by them. So yeah, I feel pretty fortunate to have worked for the people I did, just to have that kind of friendship, more friendship connection rather than employee or employee connection.
Right. So can you tell our listeners sort of the day in the life of a sled dog handler, and how does that prepare you for where you're at right now? Several years later, you have your own team, you're training your dogs for a 1,000-mile race, which we're going to jump into in a little bit, the Yukon Quest coming up in about 5-6 months or so. How does that prepare you to go? And maybe tell us what kind of goes on in the day in the life of a handler.
All the places I've handled that, it's been pretty much really good mentoring opportunity, and that's how it is for most handlers. You work with a more experienced musher and kind of operate under their training program and get to see how they do things and train their dogs the way you want them to, which is really, was really eye-opening for me. You know, Matt Hall is widely regarded as one of the better dog trainers, dog people out there. He's been around dogs for his entire life, growing up in the bush in Eagle. You get a kind of wake up and do what they want you to do. They kind of have a program lined out for you, which kind of shows you what it takes to build a competitive team. So after working for them for a few years, I had a pretty good grasp on how to build my own team. You know, and like I said, all the places I worked, I was lucky, like Matt and Ryan and I all kind of did everything together rather than just handler scooping the yard and taking care of puppies. We scooped the yard together and fed and watered together, so it was real hands-on. We were more like teammates rather than me just kind of doing all the grunt work. And that really offered me a lot of liberty and getting to run big teams. You know, I was always consistently training 12 to 16 dog teams with both of them from the time I stepped in the door. So I got real comfortable training, you know, pretty high caliber, nice dogs.
So in a lotter handler situation, it's sort of one way or the other with the handler crew being allowed to race, whether it's the B team or the puppy team or something like that. You think about somebody like the Seavies that enter two or three teams in Iditarod. Were you able to do any of those puppy or B team races with your handlers or with your mushers as you were a handler?
Yes, I was. I was able to race with Matt and Ryan. I ran the Two Rivers 200 with Matt's B team and young team. And I basically did all the training with his young dogs while he did the older dogs. And I just kind of asked him advice along the way, and he'd keep an eye on how things were going, obviously. But that really helped with the learning curve since I was basically fully responsible for training that team. So yeah, I got to run. I helped him prep, do all his drop bag work, obviously, and prep for the quest, which is a big learning experience as well, just to see how mushers pack and how they organize and how they operate in checkpoints, and handling on the quest itself is a huge, huge learning experience. Especially for somebody like Matt. I don't know if mushers out there may know if they've raced against him. If you watch him in a checkpoint, he's about as efficient as you can get. So that was really nice to be able to help pack his drop bags and see how he does everything. And then just watch him at every checkpoint. Same thing with Ryan Olson. When I handled for Ryan, I was able to run Copper Basin 300, as well as the Old Mail Trail 200 out of Nanana. So yeah, I got a lot of hands-on race experience for both those guys.
So one of the issues that comes up a lot with folks that are getting involved with mushing and they are handlers for another musher is they jump out of it too quickly. You know, they'll handle for a season or so. The next thing you know, they're out on their own and they have 25 rescue dogs in their yard, and all of a sudden they're overwhelmed. What advice can you give to folks that are just getting involved with this and, you know, or maybe handlers this year and have dreams or hopes of running one of these big races in a couple of years?
Basically just take it slow, be very tactful about how you do it. Both Matt and Ryan are pretty small kennels, so I was kind of able to see how they did it, and I kind of mimicked the same way. I got a couple really good females and was just very, very selective about the breedings I did. I don't have, you know, I have 25 dogs, and 18 of those are adults, all 18, save for one retiree. 17 of those 18 are in my main team. You know, there's no rescue dogs or excess baggage. You know, I can only afford, living on a glacier income and tour income, I can only afford to feed so many dogs. So it really pays off to have very, very high caliber dogs that you're working with. You basically just can't have a lot of, like you said, 25 rescue dogs, which is nice to have since you're helping the dogs out, but you're not going to successful program about around a bunch of other people's kind of misfit dogs, so to speak. So yeah, just be very tactful on the dogs you're trying to breed. And then, yeah, like I said, take it slow. After I worked for Matt, you know, I didn't want to just have one perspective on how people train dogs. So I went and worked for Ryan, who runs a pretty different style compared to Matt. You know, she runs half harnesses with no necklines, more of a SP kennel, Allie Zirkle and Alan Moore type program. So that was a lot different going from Matt, so I was able to see two totally different perspectives, and her dogs are also quite a bit different. They're smaller, more like 45, 50 pound on average dogs, versus Matt is known for having a little bit larger dog. So I was able to really see multiple perspectives. And then once I started breeding my first litters, I went and worked for Sven Haltman. So I wasn't actively really training his main team, but I was kind of he offered me a place to live, and I had my young puppies and was able to still help him train dogs and watch how he ran his program and ran his kennel. And he's, you know, been very successful while he was racing. Now he's running a real successful tour operation, but he still has really high caliber dogs. So, you know, I was still kind of under someone's tutelage while I was raising my young puppies before I actually moved out and bought my own property and started training my actual team.
Well, it sounds like you're doing it right. You took your time, and that's the cornerstone of your advice there. So now here you are, Riley. We're talking to Riley Dyke today. He operates Dark Horse Sled Dogs. He's up in the Fairbanks, Alaska area. That comes to my next question. Being from Colorado, and as you mentioned, from the Midwest there, and moving up to one of the coldest spots in North America, how was that as an adjustment for you, you know, when you first moved up here?
It's never been too bad of an adjustment. When I was in Colorado, I was actually in Leadville, Colorado, which is at 10,000 feet. So it doesn't have the negative 40 ambient air temperature like we do up here, but it does have 20 below pretty consistently, and then pretty high winds since elevation is so high. So he's pretty used to the cold. And then the Midwest obviously isn't always warm. So I've never struggled much to get used to the temperature part of it, at least. And then I'm kind of blessed with really warm extremities. Thankfully, I have good hands and good feet as far as not getting cold.
Right, right. So now you had mentioned that you have 25 dogs. I think you said 18 are on your main team, and then I guess you have a group of pups there. And you're training for this year's Yukon Quest. And for folks that follow Iditarod and may not follow the Quest, it is the other 1,000-mile race that happens from Fairbanks to Whitehorse, and it alternates each year on the start, and it's not an easy race by any stretch of the imagination, is it, Riley?
No, it's not. I've, like I said, handled on the Quest several times. I handled for Matt's rookie run, and then Ryan, her rookie run in the Quest, and then the year I worked for Sven, I also handled for Matt again, and that was his third run in the Quest. So, and all three of those years, it was, at least once you got to Dawson, it was never above 40 below. No matter how warm the winter is, as soon as the Quest kicks off, the temperature drops down to 30 or 40 below. So it's pretty challenging, even for the handler on those races, because you're doing a lot of driving and a lot of hands-on with the dogs on the Quest.
So, Riley, this is going to be your first 1,000-mile race, is that right?
Yep.
So for folks that are listening that don't know much about, they have a good grasp as a fan, but they don't understand a lot of, you know, the intricacies of mushing. How do you prepare not only yourself, but your dogs? And you know, give us a little bit of what's happening under the hood, so to speak, with how you're preparing for this race coming up in February.
It's just a lot of preparation, a lot of conditioning and training. Obviously, it's fall right now. We've had a really warm fall up here in Fairbanks, so it's been, by the dog standards, you know, it's been mid-40s basically every day, so it's been a lot of either real late night runs or early morning runs, and we're training on a four-wheeler right now, and the Quest is a lot of remote miles, so, and I have a young team, basically all two-year-olds, so we're going to focus on doing a lot of camping this year and training to prep for that race. We're already doing camping trip runs in training here in the fall time, and they'll be pretty consistent all the way through. So that means, you know, going out on the four-wheeler and going however many miles and then stopping for 2 to 4 hours and putting straw down for the dogs and basically just trying to duplicate a checkpoint routine so the dogs get used to resting while they're on the trail. And I really have my kind of checkpoint efficiency dialed in as far as getting them all taken care of so that I can get some rest myself during those stops.
So, Riley, are you a full-time musher? Do you have a job outside of the glacier in the summer? You know, there's really two camps with the long-distance guys and gals. They either have to work for a living and run their dogs in their off time, or they can dedicate most of the training year to their dogs. Which camp do you fit in?
I'm full-time with the dogs. So in the summer, we're on the glacier, you know, 5 to 6 days a week at least on the ice, obviously, with the dogs the whole time, and get 24 to 36 hours off at a time, generally speaking, on the ground to shower and reconnect with the rest of the world. But it's been basically every day with the dogs, and that's a good part of my income those 4 months I'm up there, since I have basically no expenses since I'm living on a glacier. And then in the winter time, I contract tours with my dogs for my friends and neighbors, Jeff and Katie Joe Dieter, who live just across the road from me, and they operate Black Spruce dog sledding. So through the training season, I'll work about 4 days a week, anywhere from 2 to 8 hours a day through the daytime hours operating tours, usually 2 to 6 hours through the peak of the training season here. And then after the Quest is over, I'll be contracting a few more tours working for them. So, yeah, all my income is solely from from operating tours. That allows me to still train a competitive schedule through the training season, but also have some income coming in operating tours for those guys.
Right. So what else are you doing this year besides the Quest? Are you running any of the other, most people call them qualifying races, like the Copper Basin or the Two Rivers or whichever. Are you signed up for any of those yet?
So I won't be running any major other races this winter. I have such a small race pool that I don't really want to risk any injuries. You know, most races are kind of inconveniently timed around the Quest. If you have a real small pool, like the Basin is only 2 weeks before, and regardless of how conservative you run that race, you're, you know, potentially going to have somebody. It's a really soft and really rugged trail, so it's not uncommon to get an athletic injury or two for the dogs in that race. So I'll be running the 65 or 64 mile run to the Alpine Creek Lodge in early December, that Alpine Creek excursion race, as a training run for them, and then potentially the Two Rivers Solstice race. But other than that, I'll just be focusing on doing a lot of big camp out runs. I have all my qualifiers done, so we're just going to basically focus on the Quest itself. Financially speaking, that makes it a little bit easier too.
So for the Iditarod, you need 750 miles, two 300-mile races, and at least a 200-mile race to qualify for Iditarod. What are the qualifications for the Yukon Quest?
The Quest is 500, I believe, one 300 and one 200. I ran the Two Rivers 200, like I said, my first year with Matt, and then I've since run the Copper Basin twice. I ran it when I handled for Ryan, and then I ran it last year with my dogs as yearlings. So I have all my qualifiers on, but yes, I believe it's a 300 and a 200 for the Quest.
So as we mentioned a bit ago about the Yukon Quest, every year it alternates its start and ending point, Fairbanks or Whitehorse. What is the year for this year?
This year it starts in Fairbanks and ends in Whitehorse. So it's nice for me, it being my rookie run, I don't have to travel down to Whitehorse 2 weeks before race start. For all the rookie meetings and things, and my dogs don't have to be traveling for that whole time. We can just get up the morning of race day and drive in town and take off, which will be a pretty big load off my mind prepping for my first 1,000-mile race.
That's literally in your backyard there at the start, and as you mentioned, if it was the other way around, you have to drive almost 1,000 miles, and it's interesting because you kind of have to go down and then over, then up. In order to get there from just about anywhere in Alaska, depending on which route you go. You know, I've also heard from other Yukon Quest mushers that are running from Whitehorse to Fairbanks, especially the Fairbanks Two Rivers mushers, is that is their home trails for their dogs, and their dogs act a bit different when they're on their own home trails. They know where home is, don't they?
Yeah, that's a big challenge for folks down in Two Rivers. Obviously, most of the main trail through Two Rivers Baseline Trail, which is kind of the keystone trail, you might say, or the superhighway that everything else kind of connects into, is the Quest Trail. So, yeah, the dogs 900 miles into a race, it's pretty appealing to want to go to their warm doghouse rather than another 70 miles to town. For me, fortunately, I live north of Fairbanks, so I'm not anywhere near the Quest Trail. But yeah, it's a big challenge to go past home at the very end of a race. It'd be like passing your bed at the end of an ultra marathon.
So a couple more questions here, Riley, before we end up on time. A lot of folks that follow the Quest know quite a bit about the two really big summits, the American Summit and Eagle Summit, and they've seen the videos and the pictures and, you know, sort of the stories of those two. Do you have any experience on those yet? And if not, are you ready to kind of conquer that challenge?
No, I don't. My first year handling when I worked for Matt is his rookie Quest for year, like I said, and we actually ran – that leg over Rosebud Summit. We didn't go all the way down Eagle Summit, but we went from Two Rivers, basically the Quest Trail from Two Rivers up to 101, and then loaded up so the dogs were able to see that first climb. So I know that portion of the trail. I've run it before going up Rosebud. As far as going down Eagle Summit, I have not done that, or obviously American Summit, but I'm not real, worried about hill climbing. I live in really, obviously those aren't hills, they're more mountains, but I live in a really hilly area, you know, this kind of where Lance Mackey lives right down the road from me, Ken Anderson, those guys. And as far as hill training goes, other than maybe, I don't know, the Caribou Hills down by in the Kenai, this is as good as it's going to get. Yeah, compared to training in tours, it's really, really consistent climbing. So I have a pretty strong hill team. So I'm not exceptionally worried about the climbing the summits. Storms obviously can throw a wrench in that always, but I'm more concerned or more anxious about just the whole preparation for a 1,000-mile race rather than the trail itself. For me, that's going to be the easier part of the whole thing. Prepping for it's a more daunting task for me personally.
Which will come into my last question. You had mentioned that you spent both Ryan and Matt getting that checkpoint process dialed in, as well as packing for the drop bags and all of that. As a rookie musher, you always hear about the rookie hump and, you know, you guys taking everything out on the trail. But with learning from those two guys, very experienced mushers on the quest, how are you preparing for that? And maybe let our listeners know what goes into sort of that drop bag prep. For some, it's ongoing through most of the winter. They're gathering supplies, and you know they'll see their in you know pictures on Facebook. They'll have their gear lined out for a few days as they get ready to pack. What is your process in getting ready for this?
Kind of the same thing that you just said, where it's an ongoing season long thing. You know, I'm already spent an hour last night pricing out booties and meat and things for the dogs. It's a little warm to buy meat yet, but come early November, I'll do a big meat order and a big booty order. And then I'll be packing booties or bundling booties and cutting meat basically from the time I get meat and booties until it's time to hand in drop bags, kind of any free time I have. A lot of time goes into those two things in particular, you know, standing at a bandsaw cutting snacks and meals for the dogs out of the meat, and then sitting inside and bundling booties for hours on end and getting those ready. I'll send out about 1,000 booties over the trail, so plus all the booties I'll use in training. So, yeah, like I said, it's kind of an ongoing year-long process, and that's how I plan to do it as well. That way it's not such a huge task to take down in January. It'll be kind of ongoing from November until late January when drop bags are due.
Riley Dyke is our guest today. Riley, do you have anything else you want to mention? Anybody you want to thank, whether it be sponsors or supporters? And also, how can folks find you, whether on social media or website or whichever?
Yeah, I'd like to thank Alaska Icefield Expeditions. They're my main sponsor, who I work for in the summertime. And then just everybody I've worked for, Matt, Ryan, Sven, learned a lot from those guys, had a lot of good split breedings and things. I got a lot of, you know, I have a really talented pool of, young dogs because I had really strong genetics to breed to with, friends of mine who do a lot of split breedings with both those kennels. That's about it. Black Spruce Dog Sledding, Jeff and Katie Joe Dieter. They allow me to be able to do this more or less since I can work for them and kind of have income throughout the winter, which I obviously would not be able to afford doing this if I wasn't able to work in the winter as well.
And your website is darkhorsesleddogs.com. You're also on Facebook under the same name. We'll make sure to put links on your show page for that. And we look forward to having you back on after the quest. How's that sound?
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. Riley Dyke today here on Mushing Radio. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.